Two names that you mentioned earlier in the program, you know, Billy and Nelson Riddle,
yeah,
Billy Mays. Here we are just about a year or so, a couple years after you first started on American Dad. You had this Music Is Better Than Words, some great nominations across the award circuit. And, you know, it's hard for me to, like, stop myself from being super giddy, like a schoolboy or a kid in a candy store in this. And I mean this not only as a kid in the candy store for sure, but best I can as a professional colleague. You know, look, there was only one Nelson Riddle, and that guy had arranging chops, scoring chops. I mean, just chops just coming out of his pores. And the way that he voiced things was staggeringly beautiful. But I have to say, and I say this with 100% sincerity, that when I heard that record for the first time, it was like being transported back into that level of quality. Not the sound of Nelson Riddle, but that level of quality. And you know, when you're arranging these kinds of things, just how important the inner voicing is on the third trumpet or the second alto, or, you know, that stuff is big. And we were talking about this a while ago when you were out working with John Wilson's band, the art of actually knowing how to play that part in the chair, which is another thing that is beyond just what notes you give them. Anyway, I think this is a landmark album. And, you know, Seth is so creative, as you know. And I love that Jimmy Van Heusen was the first track out on the album. Anybody's spring. Anyway, you know, I could go on and on about this one. I really love it. And for those that know anything about Sinatra, even if they don't know the names, this album is in that world in a fresh, modern way.
You think that money is everything, and yet it's anybody's spring. Go make a fortune, become a king, and still it's anybody's spring. And if you flash a bankroll, do you suppose a brook would care, or that a rose would say, hey, there goes a millionaire? It's more than diamonds around a ring, because it's anybody's spring. You may be born with a silver spoon, and yet it's anybody's moon. You couldn't buy a ticket to hear the first robin sing. It's free because it's anybody's spring.
Well, I'm so glad you like it. It came about, you know, Seth and I had known each other. I was one of the composers they interviewed for Family Guy right when he first came to town in 1998. And obviously I didn't wind up working on that, but then, you know, around 7-8 years later, he called up and said, hey, would you be interested in going in on American Dad? And we got together and we had lunch, and that was that. And so I was at his Christmas party one year, and he had a big orchestra there, as he does every year. And he was singing, and he came off afterwards, and I said, man, you have to do a record. When are you doing a record? And so about 6 months later, I was actually lying in the hospital. I had had terrible kidney stones, and I just had surgery to take them out. My cell phone rings on the bedstand, and I'm just feeling awful. And it's Seth, and he's like, hey, man, you want to make that record we were talking about? Yeah.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. Yeah. You made my day. So the idea was to make it as authentically as we could, to record it at Capitol as much live as we could, and recording it to analog tape to really just kind of make it a, you know, a throwback kind of thing. And, you know, I think there were many techniques in producing the record, one of which was I decided to have all the players in the room together, nobody ISO'd out. So the drums were in the room where the horns were and where the strings were. And that's a kind of sound that you have in those albums from the 50s and 60s, where everybody was in the same room and the drums are in every mic. So as a result, everything had to be pretty much kind of live performances. So we did that first record at Capitol, and it kind of comes back around to what I was saying before about studying and saying yes to everything. You know, I knew how to write for the big band. I grew up playing in big bands. I got my degree in from Miami, playing in a big band. But, you know, I wasn't a big band writer. And when I did Radioland Murders, I really had to kind of take myself back to school and study the arrangements of that time period. And I did that. Well, Radioland Murders was a CD that Seth wound up having in college and liked a lot. And that's how he knew my work. So when he came to town, that's one of the reasons why I got called in to meet on Family Guy. So it wasn't like I was a big band writer, but that's what attracted him to my work. And then I pretty much hadn't written big band since Radioland Murders. So in well over 10 years, I hadn't written anything for big band. And he says, "Hey, do you want to do this?" And I thought, okay, I got to remember how to do it. I gotta go back to school and figure out how to do it. And so I had to relearn. You were talking about voicings. I had to relearn all of that. And in fact, I reached out to one of my college professors from Miami and said, "Man, can you give me a tutorial? Let's just talk about voicings." And he was so nice, an amazing, talented guy named Gary Lindsay. And Gary helped me kind of just reacclimate my brain into the world of voicings, because as you say, it's everything. And I'm working on my 7th album now for Seth. I'm writing charts as we speak. And I'm still every single day opening up a Nelson Riddle score. How the hell did he do that? You know, just trying to look for the secret sauce in there. And even having the scores, sometimes I still can't figure out why it sounds the way it sounds. You know, but, you know, if you're doing it right, you really have to go that extra step and figure out what makes Billy May and Nelson Riddle's charts and Gordon Jenkins, what makes those sound so unique? I mean, I hear a Billy May chart and I know it's Billy May like that. I hear Nelson Riddle chart and I know it's not Billy May. Why? You know, how did they do that? Well, how did Billy May get that massive sound out of the big band? Well, okay, for one, usually he had 5 trumpets. But it was also the couplings, how he coupled the trumpets and the trombones with overlapping voices, and then where he fit in the saxophones in those voices, where he kind of moved those couplings around and what notes got doubled. What notes didn't get doubled. You know, those kind of things matter, because the harmonic resonances between, you know, frequencies, like if you've got a third in a chord and then you've got a flat 9 in a chord, you know, that buzz, that rub is either going to be your friend or your foe, depending on where you put it. Right.
Yeah. It's refreshing hearing you talk about score study at this phase in your career, because you know, I know we agree that you're never going to have enough time to learn enough.
It never ends.
But it's an important thing, I think, for especially some of our young listeners to grab onto. And I'll share just a very quick story on the opposite end of the spectrum. You know, to remain nameless, one of my professors at university many years ago now already, more than I'd like to say. I asked him, I was 19, I was a sophomore in college, and I said, you know, Professor so-and-so, I'm just kind of curious, you know, what scores are you studying right now? You know, what are some of the things that really excite you? And he took me aside in the corner, and he kind of said to me, he's like, "Well, you know, I'm a little bit past score study." And I've never forgotten those words ever, because I thought it was one of the most incorrect answers I've ever received from anyone I looked up to throughout my education, and your education never ends. So I think that what you're saying is what is to be embraced and what should be you know, given attention and time to, because you're right. You'll never have enough time in the day to learn what we want to learn. And
sometimes it also amounts to relearning things.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much to know in being a composer that you're ultimately going to forget about something, or you just need dusting off. Or sometimes I look at it as priming the pump. Like if I'm, I do this on the Orville a lot, if I'm working and I've got a scene and I just feel kind of tapped out of good ideas, I'll just stop working. Hmm. And maybe I'll go pull out Barber Symphony
or
something. And I'll just put that on and I'll hear one little thing that'll go, oh, that's an interesting idea. How about if I took that color and I started doing this and I developed something out of it? And it's just a primer in the pump that gets your motor started. So it's enormously important for young composers and old composers to keep looking at scores. You know, conductors never stop looking at scores.
Right.
You know, score study is a lifetime work. It shouldn't be any different for composers, I don't think.
Not at all. It's one of my favorite things that I had seen you working on. This was years ago. You had shared it with me actually in the studio you're in now. And one of the reasons I want to bring it up is because how kind of innovative it was from a themed entertainment perspective when it came out in 2012 to celebrate its 20th anniversary of Disneyland Paris, the Disney Dreams. One of the things that stuck out to me in a really big way back then was 3D mapping use. And it wasn't that well developed. The technology was still very young and almost in its infancy in 2012. And to see this amazing idea and concept that came between, you know, yourself and the Imagineers, it was so dang cool. And it's still super fresh. I sat there the first time I ever went with my wife and I just videotaped the whole thing. And it's a long show to keep your arm up and not move the whole time. So my kids could have like a really well-framed, non-moving video when I came home. And they still love watching it to this day. Anyway.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a fun one. You know, what was the collaborative spirit and process like in that one? Because working in themed entertainment is a little bit different than film. Certainly the product is different and how you get there is different.
Yeah, a super fun project and remains so. It's still playing every night in Paris. Up until now, that was 365 days a year for the last 8 years. They average 20 to 25,000 people a night.
Wow.
So you're thinking, you know, millions of people have watched this show. When we started, as you say, the animation was there in kind of fairly rough form, but I was never really going to see what it looked like finished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were describing, well, there's going to be all this pyro and there are going to be these fountain screens that they're going to be able to project animation on these screens of mist, all these things and lasers. Wasn't there in the work prints of the animation that I had. So I had to just kind of go for it and use my imagination. But the fun thing about this show is it's all music front to back. There's really hardly any dialogue. It's just the story is driven by the score and the songs. And what is it? About 18 minutes, I think. And so we do it in pieces, and we had a huge orchestra at Abbey Road in London. But it wasn't until I finally got to go and see the show that it just blew my mind. And it blew my mind for a couple of reasons. First of all, the creators at Imagineering, Steve Davison and his team, are just incredibly creative and hardworking people. They spent night after night after night after the park is closed, getting the projection just right, getting the fireworks just right. They just spent months and months getting the show up on its feet. So the idea was, at the end of the show, they kind of wanted a good night song, a lullaby, right? And I had written a theme for the Disney Dreams, and we decided to write a song out of it.
Is this one the main one? There were starts. It's a different tune, from the fanfare.
It's a lullaby, and it's sung by this wonderful singer from Ireland, Cara Dillon. Mm. And it's just, God, I'm forgetting what the name of the song is now. The show is over. Crash, boom, bang, the biggest fireworks display, you know, like the end of the world, right? I even heard one little girl go, "Why did they blow up the castle, Daddy?" But so I'm standing there in the booth where they kind of direct things, which is kind of center stage. And the lights come up and you see this, just a sea of people and little kids on their dad's shoulders walking back quietly after their day of fun at Disneyland, and this beautiful lullaby with Cara Dillon starts to play. And I'm seeing like 25,000 people entirely silent, walking out with their beautiful little children, listening to this beautiful singer sing a song. And no one's really talking.
Yeah.
And I teared up and I thought, this happens every single night.
Yeah.
These families having this moment with their children. And I thought, man, this is a really good way to spend your life, you know, making a living. This is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Themed entertainment is a really special space. And, you know, especially when you get it right. I mean, we all have our own memories, particularly, you know, being out here, we're all locals to Disneyland, right? So whether or not it's Disneyland or Universal or, you know, whatever, but we have a lot of themed entertainment around here. And we all have a story like that where we did something and that ride was just right, or that experience was just right, or, you know, that walk through Tink's Forest right outside, you know, the spaceship spinners at Disneyland, you know, the mood is just right with your music there. Theme entertainment's a really, really cool space. Definitely entertaining, but not themed entertainment. A Million Ways to Die in the West. A million ways to laugh your ass off. You know, if there ever was a Western to, you know, follow in the footsteps of Mel Brooks and do it in a fresh and unique way. So we're going to have a look at one of the great scenes from the film. There are many of them, but this one is just so funny, and it's so Seth, right? You know, if we're going to do a dance, we're going to do any kind of dance in my Western movie, it's going to be to a song about mustaches. And so, you know, if you only have a mustache in this... This song originally was written by Stephen Foster in 1864 or 65, and the arrangement is super fun, and, you know, it's right there in the style and the fiddles and the kind of washed up feeling and the clickety clacks with the shoes. So let's have a quick look at this scene, and we'll come back in a moment.
You men who long for love, you mustn't all despair. There's a secret you should know. To the hearts of the fair, you may not have the looks, you may not have the dash, but you'll win yourself a girl if you've only got a mustache, a mustache, a mustache, if you've only got a mustache. You may be common folk without a hint of pride, but you needn't be a king to make any maiden a bride. You may not have the name, you may not have the cash, but you'll make that girl your own if you
mustache, a mustache, a mustache, if you've only got a mustache. You may be big and fat, or uglier than sin. All the ladies shut you out, you're wondering how to get in. Well, here is my advice for how to make a splash. You can have your pick of gals if you've only got a mustache. A mustache, a mustache, if you've only got a mustache. A mustache, a mustache, a mustache. Big mustache, thick mustache, my mustache, your mustache. Say the word mustache.
A mustache, a mustache.
Now we both have said mustache. A mustache, a mustache. If you've only got a mustache.
So for those out there that aren't aware that Seth MacFarlane kind of changed some of the lyrics on this, the original lyrics can be found, you know, just out there to the Stephen Foster song. This one, I just get curious. Is that Margaret playing the fiddle by any chance?
No. That was Gabe Witcher.
Okay.
From the Punch Brothers with Chris Thiele. And
fun.
Also Noam Pikelny, the great banjo player from the Punch Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty all-star band. You'll notice some of the instruments that I got involved. The art director called me and said, you know, help me think up some funny instruments. And I said, well, of course you got the washboard thing, right? But I said, how about you try and make a guitar out of a shovel? So there's a guy there playing a shovel with two strings, you know, I mean, a violin made out of a cigar box. Stuff like that.
It's fun. I mean, you know, that's a fun one, different than what we've kind of talked about in the program. You know, it's a kind of a cool arrangement of something that, you know, is hundreds of years old, almost hundreds of years old. But let's talk a little bit about just the movie in general. You know, we all know around the world just how brilliant, you know, Seth's mind really is through the eyes of comedy, and not even just comedy. Like he's done some really cool serious stuff too, and he knows when to kind of pivot left or right. That's one of the things that makes him so brilliant is timing. Timing in a comedy from a composer's perspective is very different than kind of the approach to timing in a serious drama or an action film, although perhaps it shares more with action than it does, you know, with long-form drama. But I'm kind of curious, you know, what this was like for you. You'd been worked with him before already on a number of things. It's a comedy. It's a giant thing in the West. You can open up a little bit. But there's also some really intimate things in the picture, too. So the floor is yours.
Well, this was one of the most fun projects in every way that I've ever worked on. And yes, you're right. I mean, the mind of Seth is enormously entertaining and enormously challenging to work with in a good way. You know, the mustache song, that's just something he knew, you know, that he found a way to fit into the script. And so you mentioned about scoring for drama and comedy. In this case, he was very clear that he wanted the score to never comment on the comedy. Mm-hmm. The score was always to play it dead serious. So in fact, that made it kind of much easier because you just barrel right through the comedic moments, you know, with dramatic music.
Well, and to your hero, you know, Elmer Bernstein, you know, you brought him up at the very beginning. He was one of the first guys that was amazing at that, right? I mean,
yeah. And yes, exactly. And so the models were, you know, Jerome Morris, How the West Is Won, Alfred Newman, Elmer, of course. We listened to a lot of classic film scores before we got going on this. And, you know, this movie is one of the very few movies of its time to have a main title sequence, you'll notice.
Yeah, that's a big one.
It's almost a 4-minute main title of just beautiful shots of Monument Valley and the orchestra just kicking ass. I remember some very, very strong debates that were going on with the studio. Like, can we please cut the main title sequence? Nobody wants to sit through those anymore. And Seth was absolutely adamant that this was part of the style. This was part of the genre. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm writing the theme, and I do a mock-up of the theme. I don't do it. I have one of my colleagues do it, because I'm terrible at those, or I just don't have the patience. So we get this elaborate mock-up done of the what became the main title, and you know, the practice nowadays for people that don't know is that you used to write a cue, you'd get your themes approved and whatnot, but you'd write a piece of music, a sequence, and the filmmakers would hear it for the first time at the session. Then you would adjust it to their notes, to their desires, while the orchestra was there. That has all changed with computers and samplers and some incredible libraries that sound very much like a real orchestra. So now I can write a piece of music and it gets put through samplers. And, you know, to some people, they would have a hard time telling the difference between a real orchestra, even though it is quite a bit different. But it's a lot of work. So I do this main title sequence. And Seth calls me up and said, "Man, that's great. I love it. Let me ask you a question. These mock-ups, they're a lot of work, right?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I mean, they take some time." He goes, "Look, you know, I hired you. I know what you can do. I want you to spend your time writing. Just go ahead and write the score and I'll hear it at the session. And I'm sure it'll be great."
Wow.
You don't have to write any mock-ups.
Wow.
Now that just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
And so what that did was, it was so liberating, because it took me back to the days of Iron Will and Young Indy, where, you know, you're just spending all your waking moments creating and not trying to produce a decent sounding mock-up and worrying about, you know, how the mix of the mock-up is or anything. You're just creating. And it was quite freeing, quite freeing. And so, yeah, an enormously fun score to write and very challenging for the orchestra. The orchestra just did an incredible job. My colleagues here in LA has played the crap out of it. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel each one of these is kind of a gift,
yeah,
you know, a gift to your life, because going back to Iron Will, I mean, that was just a great experience. And it's a something you carry through the decades as a chapter of your life, which is,
yeah,
is very valuable.
Well, you've special. Been very, very generous with your time. I got two quick final questions. What are you working on now? And either former or current recording studios here in LA, do you have a favorite?
Right now I'm working on American Dad. I'm writing album number 7 for Seth.
Right on.
We have 5 have been released. The 6th one that I did not arrange, Bruce Broughton did the arrangements, spectacular arrangements from Bruce, and kind of stepping into a world that he had not visited all that often, and just did an amazing job. So I produced that. We're finishing up the vocals on that. And then I'm writing the arrangements for the 7th album, which is going to be a more symphonic concert kind of album than a big band album. We were supposed to record that in the fall. Everything has been pushed back.
Yeah.
Nobody knows when. And then season 3 of the Orville is going to start for me very soon. They've got, you know, a percentage of it shot. They had to stop mid-production. So I'll be writing probably, you know, as much as I can on what they've gotten shot, and we'll just bank the scores. But it's unclear when we'll be able to get back into a studio. You know, when are you going to be able to have 90 players in a room,
yeah,
sitting close to each other? Nobody knows. I'm confident we'll figure it out. But so there's lots to do, but there are no live sessions happening right now,
yeah,
which is, you know, was always the treat for getting out of your monk-like existence to go into a studio with your colleagues of amazing players and have that experience of everybody playing together.
Right.
I do miss that, but there's, you know, as I say, I'm confident it'll come back. It may be changed, but there's just no way to replace live concerts, live recordings. It can't be replaced. It'll be back. As to which is my favorite studio, I would have to say Sony, hands down. MGM, the old MGM studio.
Yeah.
I think it's just a gorgeous sounding room. That's my favorite in town. Here in London, Abbey Road is just a very special place.
Yes. It's,
again, a different sounding room, but just so gorgeous. Sony to me is useful for so many different things. It can be so many different things. I was lucky enough to work on a record with Pat Metheny, his recent record, which had about a 35 piece orchestra on it. We recorded for 5 days in Sony. And it worked great for that, you know, for just really difficult, jazz, you know, very complex meters and it can work, you know, great for ET and, you know, whatever else, Over the Rainbow that was recorded there. Sony is a very special place. You know, the stages are, we always worry.
Yeah,
we
I know.
Worry
I
because
know.
They're enormously expensive to maintain. It's a lot of real estate that the studios could be making a lot more money if they used it in other ways. So we worry that Sony will stay. Fox stage, I cross my fingers. I think it's, you know, I think it's in good health. I think it's the Newman stage is used often, and it's a great stage, irreplaceable. But you know, there aren't a lot of other stages anymore. I mean, they're slowly closing them all down.
Yeah, it's a real shame. It's a real shame. We've lost a lot of history, even just in the last 10 years.
I mean, with losing Todd AO,
it was a big one.
Where Iron Will was recorded, it's now offices for a nighttime entertainment show. Paramount, that's gone.
Yeah,
Universal is gone for a long time. So, you have no choice but to remain optimistic.
Yep,
because there is no substitute for live orchestral recording. And you need spaces to do that. I'm encouraged that they're being built in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
That good rooms are cropping up in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
Prague, good rooms, and there's a really nice group that's doing things in the old Teldec studio in Berlin.
Yeah, I've heard some stuff out
there. Rooms in Australia. The rooms, Nashville, I understand. There's a huge new scoring stage being built. So we'll go wherever it is. Hopefully we get to stay here. Our first choice is always to work with our colleagues here. But
absolutely. There's a lot of variables. What I'm about to say comes with a grain of salt, but there's a lot of variables that go into the inertia of music making here in LA. But, it seems you can almost fairly safely say that in a lot of ways we're shooting ourselves in the foot and, embracing the type of recording environment that we need to for it to continue to flourish. And there are people around the world that are getting wise to that, as they should. That is just a natural equilibrium of evolution. And then again, we're seeing that outside of LA. So I hope it's not we end up at the precipice of something at some point where it's too late, where we finally get it. I hope not. But as I share that with you, the optimism, the hope, and when we come back from all this COVID stuff that is unique to itself, I think, and I also hope that we're going to be much more appreciative of certain things. And I look forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And I'll be the first to buy a ticket when you're back in the concert hall putting on one of your magnificent film scores.
Oh, I appreciate it. We'll have to have you at it one of these soon, sooner than later. Well, as I said, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on the program. I know all of our fans out there around the world are going to dial in to all of these. I think we have so much amazing content. I think we'll turn this into a multi-part series. So Joel McNeely, thank you so much for coming on today. And, best of luck with everything you're writing. And we'll see you on the other side.
My pleasure. Stay healthy and safe, everybody.
Thank you. And we'll see you all for the next Film Music Focus. Until then, stay cool.
Brought to you by Cine Concerts.